This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. It took writer Christine Hale a long time to make sense of her most difficult life experiences, among them a deeply troubled relationship with her mother, a teen marriage, and a bitter divorce from her second husband. As an adult, she stumbled onto Tibetan Buddhism and a path toward acceptance. And when her parents died, she felt compelled to begin writing her stories down. In her new memoir, A Piece of Sky, A Grain of Rice, she layers these memories into a cohesive whole. The Los Angeles Review of Books referred to her memoir as a case study in the collage approach to memoir writing. Christine Hale earned her MFA from Warren Wilson College. She lives in Asheville, and she teaches in the Great Smokies Writing Program and joins me now from public radio station WCQS in Asheville. Christine Hale, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
You started out as a novelist, and now you've written your memoir. What drove you to write this memoir?
It insisted. It took over my life. I think that most of us gain some perspective on our past with the passage of time, but it's hard to really make sense of what has befallen us without thinking about it in an organized way. And for those of us who are writers, writing is the way we think. So after my mother passed away, as you mentioned, the long and difficult relationship with her after she passed away, I found myself helplessly asking the unanswerable questions about her and about my father and about their marriage and about my growing up, the unintended hostage to that marriage. And the memoir was the eventual result of that.
You talked about organizing your thoughts, and yet, as I mentioned, this is a collage style, a different way of putting together the themes and the stories. Talk about this particular style that you employ for your memoir.
Yes, thank you. Like a collage of photographs. Most people have made one of those at one time, and I didn't initially have that plan for the book, but I had these several storylines. You know, there was the tattooing ritual with my adult children, young adult children. There's the Buddhism. There's the family dynamic story. And I knew that I felt that those fit together somehow, but I couldn't explain it to myself or anyone else until I began to create a collage of the memories. And I've come to understand that it suits this book, this material, this approach does, because that's the way memory works for most of us. We seldom remember things, make sense of things in a straight line. We remember this, we remember that from very different times. And it is only in the way that the memories refract on each other that we begin to intuitively sense some meaning or takeaway from that.
Well, take us back to those earliest days. And again, what your mother said to you and about you that no child should ever have to imagine or ever hear.
Yes, I was a late-life child. My mother was 45 when I was born, and my two older sisters were 10 and 8 years older than me. The middle sister is intellectually disabled from birth. So my mother had a hard life in many ways, and she had struggled with depression and other problems. But she did say to me when I was a small child, she would tell me again and again when she was feeling really down, that while she was pregnant and during my birth, she had prayed that we both would die. And I took that quite seriously as a small child and a medium-sized child, that I was responsible for her unhappiness as well as the attempt to make her happy. So it gave me a long-term burden to deal with.
I wonder if I can ask you to read for us.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to read a little bit about, actually this has to do with my father. I had such enmeshment with my mother, so much struggle with her, that I feel like I hardly knew my father until he was really very old, until she'd passed away. And this is a memory that came up that has to do with me coming to terms with what my enmeshment with her had done to my relationship with him. So I'll just jump right in with reading. On some school or Girl Scout field trip, I once purchased little souvenirs in a mountain gift shop for each member of my family, taking care to pick just the right emblematic thing for each person. For my father, I confidently chose a silvered plastic loving cup 2 inches high, emblazoned World's Best Liar. I don't remember that I had any direct evidence of my father telling lies, but my mother told me so often what a liar he was that the gift seemed simply perfect. It was not until I presented it to him, and he turned on his heel, unmistakable pain and fury on his face, that I considered what the designation might mean to him. I was frankly stunned to realize he had feelings. That betrayal of him on her terms made me loathe myself in that moment, and any time I recalled it for years afterward. In each bout of regret, I would try for a while to become more neutral toward him, but it was too late. I had the habit of dismissing him, and he did not trust me. He did not like me, either. He told me as much at some point in his last years, how superior and stuck up I'd acted, how all I'd ever cared about was pleasing her, how as a result she gave me, at his expense, anything I wanted. But my father did love me. He never injured me, and he didn't fight with me. For most of my life, he stayed out of my way and off my radar, living his life and bearing his troubles in complete silence as far as I was concerned. When I came home to visit as a young adult, infrequently until I had children, his bear hugs at the moment of my arrival and my departure bookended whatever chaotic emotional engagement I'd had with my mother. Each time my children and I boarded a return flight to New York or Bermuda or Florida, he stood by himself on the observation deck to watch the plane out of sight before driving home alone to his recliner and TV in the basement, and my mother, inert and fuming, upstairs. I felt for him then. My children had softened me. My miserable marriage had wised me up. His lonely, unrequited old man devotion made me burn with shame and pity I had no words for. And then I attempted to find words writing the memoir.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Christine Hale is reading from her memoir, A Piece of Sky, A Grain of Rice, a memoir in four meditations. You talked about sort of putting these pieces, these collage photos together, different experiences from different times, and how they ultimately, it's the juxtaposition or positioning of these that gives meaning to this. But you do say that in the moment you obviously felt something. I was frankly stunned when you handed him that cup and he reacted, frankly stunned to realize that he had feelings. Well, mm-hmm. What was it like for you to come back so many years later, and how did you or did you recontextualize that moment, how you felt at that moment?
Well, in the moment, there was that shame, and shame usually shuts us up. Shuts us up and shuts us down. And of course, I was maybe 8, 9 years old at the time that happened. And so decades later, I had to re-experience that shame. I mean, writing the memoir certainly caused me to feel a lot of painful things. But one of the tenets of Buddhism is, I'm sure many people have heard about letting go. Letting go requires us to recognize what we're letting go of before we can be free of it. So re-experiencing that shame, as I wrote about it, hurt. But it also allowed me over time, as writing and rewriting it, to realize that, yes, I did that. Yes, I hurt his feelings. And that's regrettable. But he did love me. And he did hang in there right to the end with being my father, loving me even when he didn't like me. And that's a quite a wonderful human truth.
And you got to think about this as a parent yourself. The book deals with your approach to parenting.
Yes.
And it begins and ends with together tattoos. Tell us about the tattoos.
Yes, I couldn't not write about that as a writer. I was a single mother for my two children for about 10 years. And near as they began to leave the nest, my daughter had left for college. My son was almost that old. This was in 2005 and was the beginning of the tattoo craze, I guess. And they came up together without discussing it with me first with the idea that we should get tattoos together, each one different, but each one incorporating part of the other's inking. So we were going to be linked with ink. And they said to me, let's do this instead of Christmas presents this year. And I was taken aback, but I also understood by that time that when teenagers offer you the chance to do something with them that represents love, you should do it on their terms without questioning it. I mean, I guess, I suppose as long as it's not life-threatening.
Right.
So
right.
We did undertake the together tattoo.
Well, and there's almost nothing you can do with teens that doesn't draw blood, so why not
yes.
get a tattoo?
That's
I know
true.
I am with you there. But now, you also went through a very messy divorce, and then this, and we can talk about that, but I really want you to take us on the path to Buddhism and how all
yes.
of this led you to Tibetan Buddhism.
Yes, I had been interested in Buddhism, in stories and so forth for many years, but I had not practiced Buddhism until I stumbled into it during the first year of the divorce. And curiously, it was my ex-husband who found the Buddhist group and asked me to take the children there when he went out of town, and I did, and I'm the one who stuck with it. What the Tibetan Buddhist practice provided for me was a place to be still, to sit down on the cushion and to chant, which is the essence of Tibetan Buddhism, required me to stop running around like a frightened maniac, at least for the hour or two that I was there. And one stills the body in Tibetan Buddhism and all forms of Buddhism so that insights may arise. And that's what Buddhism did for me. But along the way, I acquired this Buddhist teacher, a female Buddhist teacher, who was quite unusual. And she was, I came to understand eventually that she was kind of an odd mother to me, not a friendly mother, but one who really put my feet in the fire and caused me to start looking at my life rather than running from it.
Well, that sounds, and again, I think that's, you put your finger on a very important point here. Earlier, you talked about being still and confronting this, and there's a kind of romantic, almost, a placid view of allowing things to finally melt away. But it's difficult in that moment, isn't it? I mean, there's a reason we run from these things. They're painful.
Yes.
What was it like when you first sat down and let these things happen in your mind?
Well, on the cushion, the meditation cushion, my heart would be pounding sometimes. Sometimes I would be crying while I was sitting and chanting. But I had made the commitment to sit for X amount of time, 20 minutes, an hour or whatever. And I just kind of experientially, you find that you survive. and I think that when any of us is faced with a terrible life trauma, it is the feeling that it will never end, the fear that it will never end, that is almost worse than the thing itself. And so that the practice then helps one experience the passage of time and that it changes.
I've already experienced the pain. I don't have to continue to suffer.
Yes.
You talked about the importance of your teacher through this process and how they may have guided you, she may have guided you in those difficult moments. Maybe you could read a passage about your teacher from your memoir.
Yes, I have just a little bit here that captures the essence of her, I believe. I have a Buddhist teacher, and she describes herself this way. I just old lady. Next comes a chuckle that might or might not be tongue-in-cheek. She never reveals her exact age. My guess is she's somewhere between 80 and 90 years old. She came of age like the rest of the dwindling number of still-living Tibetan lamas exiled by the Chinese takeover in 1959, as an aristocrat in a feudal theocracy. Her form is stolid and lumpy, layered in many colors and textures of thrift store sweatpants, skirt, undershirt, and sweater. Her breathing is often audibly labored. Her English is limited, but her mind, her wit, and her tongue are razor sharp. For the first years I tried to follow her, she did not acknowledge me. For some years after that, I had no name she claimed to remember. When asking others to fetch me, she referred to me in a tone of mild derision as writer lady. When she did finally begin to address me directly, it was only to pound me each and every time with a single horrifying question, what you do wrong?
That was author Christine Hale reading from her memoir, A Piece of Sky, A Grain of Rice, a memoir in four meditations. What were you doing wrong, and why did you stick with it? Many people would be chased away by that.
What was I doing? It was a question, something like a koan in the Zen tradition. Mm-hmm. What are you doing wrong? She didn't ask me to answer it.
Mm-hmm.
She did not guide me toward the answer, but I thought I was doing just about everything wrong. And then over time, contemplating that, I began to see that allowing things to be as they were, I guess, to make the simplest statement of it, allowing things to be as they were and simply do the best I could was all I could do. And with that bit of relaxation, of mental relaxation, there was more room to experience the sweetnesses that were there also in life always.
This practice resulted in a lot of adventures for you, including a trip to Tibet where you witnessed something called a sky burial. Tell us that story.
Yes, I went to Tibet with a group of practitioners and tourists as well, led by a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner. We Went to Lhasa, of course, the capital of Tibet, but we also went deep into mountainous areas of Tibet to a monastery, and there, with special permission, hiked way up to close to 17,000 feet to a place where the sky burial was being done. And what a sky burial is, I believe it's similar to some Native American traditions in the climate of Tibet, where there is no wood. It's barren, no wood to burn bodies, and no ability to bury bodies in the permafrost. The bodies are exposed to the elements to dissolve, but also offered to the vultures to eat. And the reason for this in Tibetan understanding, Tibetans have to eat meat because they have nothing else in a barren climate. They have to eat their yaks and their sheep. So at their death, then they are offered back to the animals in the form of the vultures. So that's the karmic cycle. Anyway, we were not supposed to see the sky burial, very secret and special. We did have permission to hike around the area, but there was not supposed to be one going on. And once we realized that there was one going on, we couldn't turn around and back up because when you circumambulate, you go around a holy site. You have to go around it clockwise. It's very inauspicious to turn around, very, very inauspicious. It would have compounded the cultural affront to turn around. So we just had to keep marching by, and I was looking and not looking, and I saw and I didn't see bodies, the dead body being hacked apart in the ritual manner. I did see the vultures waiting. And when I got up to the top where we all sat down to rest, I was just so exhausted. I'd been sick for weeks, for many days with altitude sickness and food poisoning. I sat down in the mud and I felt very unspiritual. And that turned out to be the source of insight, you know, later, realizing that we might expect to have a peak spiritual experience, and it turns out to be, hey, that's what life is. We all die.
Christine Hale, I'm going to leave it right there, and to find out more, we'll have to read your book, A Piece of Sky, A Grain of Rice. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can find out more about Christine Hale and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.